Session will be by Karen Hilliard. She's an assistant professor of health promotion and behavior at the University of Georgia College of Public Health, where she teaches health communication and social marketing. She's been researching vaccine behavior and decision making for the past 6 years, beginning with hypothetical scenarios designed to improve public health preparedness for avian flu and later analyzing actual behavior during the H1N1 swine flu outbreak, including which we'll talk about here today. She's currently engaged in several vaccine-related research projects, including two examining communication during the current pertussis outbreak, one exploring rhetoric and tactics of the anti-vaccine movement, another researching vaccine decision-making among pregnant women, and one seeking root causes of persistent vaccine disparities among adult African Americans.
All right. Hi. I'm going to talk today about a study that was conducted during the swine flu outbreak from 2009 to 2010. And I want to say, first of all, that in retrospect, of course, the swine flu outbreak is seen by a lot of people as the pandemic that really wasn't, because it was so mild by comparison even to typical flu seasons. But I think it's important to give you the context of this study by taking you back a little bit to the early days of that pandemic and what we now know in hindsight, you know, looked a little bit different as it was unfolding in real time. First of all, the outbreak began on the heels of federal preparedness planning for avian flu, which we were expecting to be a potentially very deadly pandemic at some point in the future. So there was that context. The virus that became known as H1N1, swine flu, was a completely unknown new virus. The first patient who was identified was a 10-year-old in Mexico. And actually the second patient who was identified was an 8-year-old in California. So after that, there was then a cluster of cases in a high school in New York. And before the end of that month, there had been nearly 2,000 cases, 84 deaths. And we also were learning as this epidemic and then later a pandemic unfolded that in those first cases, about 60% of the patients were age 24 and under. And that was 14 times the incidence level for adults over 60. So it was exactly the opposite of what normally happens in seasonal flu. There was a great deal of anxiety about how severe the virus was going to be once flu season was really upon us, because this started in April and we were anticipating that it could be quite bad come that fall. And there was a scramble to develop an H1N1 vaccine. It was finally available in October of that year, and when it first became available, supplies were limited, there was high demand, and the people who were in priority groups were really the only folks who could get that vaccine. Children aged 6 months of age and older were in one of the priority groups. So ultimately, even though this outbreak was not that bad, we didn't know how it was going to unfold at the time. And that uncertainty and fear was being captured and amplified every day in the media. So given all of that, it's rather surprising to learn that in the context of this potentially deadly outbreak that was unfolding, that only 40% of children were vaccinated during the pandemic. And so we wondered why that was. I mean, wouldn't most parents at that time have wanted their children to be protected? So before we examined our data for an answer, we took a look at some of the factors that the past studies have shown are associated with either vaccine refusal or vaccine acceptance. And we know from past studies that about a third of parents are vaccine hesitant at some point or another. There's a lot of fear about the safety of vaccines. There is concern that vaccines may transmit disease themselves. There is the erroneous perception that it's better to catch the disease and develop your own natural immunity. Or for some parents, the idea that if there is any doubt out there about the safety of a vaccine, that it's better not to give the vaccine. It's the omission bias. Better to do nothing than to do something that could cause harm, like giving your child a vaccination. And of course, there's the context of general mistrust out there among some groups of the government and other groups of pharmaceutical companies. We know also that there are things that influence parents to vaccinate. Some of those things include understanding a little bit better what the disease is and how it might affect the person who's receiving the vaccination, their perception of the risk, how likely they are to catch the disease, how likely it is to be bad if they do. There are recommendations from people that parents trust. Those can be very influential. Concern about the impact on the community, about other people, and the importance of vaccinating as a collective effort. And then also help in overcoming barriers to vaccination, like inconvenience or cost. Those are things that can influence the decision to vaccinate. And interestingly, some past studies have also shown that lack of insurance is actually associated with higher levels of vaccination. So when we looked at our data then, which was collected sort of at the very end of the greatest period of fear and uncertainty, and it was part of a longitudinal study that was funded by the CDC, we surveyed about just over 2,000 adults in January and February of 2010. And remember, the vaccine had been available since the beginning of October, and it was only released to the general population in December. So up until that time, it had been reserved for priority groups only. Our sample was demographically representative of the United States. We conducted the survey through using knowledge networks. And about 684 of our total sample were parents of children under 18. And we talked to them very conversationally about swine flu and the questions that we asked. We never used H1N1. We talked about the current influenza outbreak and also called it swine flu. We divided our sample into two parts, those who did not vaccinate any of their children and those who vaccinated at least one child. Because for some parents, children may have underlying health conditions that would prevent vaccinations. So if they vaccinated at least one of their children, we considered them to be pro-vaccination. We looked very carefully for the influence of demographics, and also then later controlled for demographics and for whether or not people had insurance. We then used the health belief model as a framework to really understand the decision-making process with all the traditional categories of the health belief model. And I'm going to come back to our analysis of this in just a minute. We felt that I will back up to say that we did not plan this particular portion of the study ahead of time. We were very much working in real time ourselves as researchers as this unfolded to deploy the survey. This was the second of the surveys that went out as part of our longitudinal study. So our questions didn't fit perfectly into the health belief model, but generally speaking, they did. And so, perceived risk was part of it, costs and benefits, cues to action, self-efficacy. The costs and benefits, I will note that we did not handle those in the traditional way that they are handled in typically with the health belief model, where costs are subtracted from benefits. Instead, we created an index because of the complexity of some of those costs and benefits. And I'm going to come back to that in just a moment, too. So that's why they appear together here. When we looked at our descriptives, just a few of the top-line results, they looked a lot like the country did. They were pretty representative. About 40% of the parents in our survey had vaccinated at least one of their children. At first, when we looked at descriptives, we thought that race and age looked like they were going to be significant. But actually, when we then controlled for everything else, they were not. And in the overall model, they were not significant at all. And there was also no relationship between insurance coverage and vaccination when we looked at either the descriptives or the model later on. So coming back to the health belief model, we used structural equation modeling to conduct this analysis, and the health belief model explained 38% of the variance in vaccine behavior. So it was a pretty good fit. What was very surprising to us, though, when we examined the variables in the health belief model, was to find that perceived risk had no impact as a predictive variable on whether parents would vaccinate or not. So thinking that your child was likely to get swine flu and thinking that the disease could be quite serious if your child got it did not lead to vaccination when we looked at it in this model. What was significant was costs and benefits and self-efficacy, but what was most significant of all were cues to action. Cues to action was by far the most important predictor. How much people were influenced by these cues then predicted whether or not they would vaccinate their children. And these cues included not only the influence of important trusted people, friends, family, but also influence of the media, influence of healthcare providers, and interestingly, the influence of whether or not President Obama vaccinated his daughters, knowing that. And that was something that held up even when we controlled for political affiliation and race. It was still highly influential and predictive of whether or not parents would vaccinate. We also conducted a cluster analysis of our sample when it came to some of the costs and benefits of vaccine, really the perception of vaccine risk versus disease risk. And we found that our sample fell roughly by thirds into three different categories. There was a group, about 40%, who were very worried. They were worried about H1N1. They were also worried about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. However, this group was 77% more likely to vaccinate. And incidentally, this group included a higher proportion of African-Americans and Hispanic respondents than we had in the sample. So they tended to be in this cluster among the three clusters to choose from. There was also a cluster that we referred to as the unconcerned, about 28%. They weren't worried about H1N1. They weren't worried about vaccines. They weren't worried about any of this. And finally, there were the vaccine averse, about 31%, people that were not concerned about the disease, but were very concerned about vaccine. And incidentally, I don't think Jenny McCarthy was actually part of our sample, but it was such a good photo, and she was such the perfect person to put in there that I chose that one. So there are several takeaways from our study, and I apologize that my co-presenters here have given you great tables and statistics, and I have not. I actually had some trouble getting my tables to fit on the PowerPoint, but I've got all that material, and we'd be glad to send it to any of you if you're interested in taking a closer look at our statistical analyses. But some takeaways that I have for communicators, and then I'm going to talk about some takeaways for researchers. First of all, seeing the impact of cues to action and how much more important that was than perceived risk was very enlightening. Because so often messages about vaccination focus on the risk of the disease and the severity of the disease. But it seemed to us that based on this, perhaps more affirming messages or role models, modeling of behavior, might be more effective means of persuading parents to vaccinate. The importance of those cues to action suggests that some areas of focus in our education campaigns and behavioral campaigns could be social media, could be developing narrative stories or testimonials, whether from other parents or friends, neighbors, celebrities, whoever. Also that healthcare providers, rather than focusing on the scary messages, might themselves tell some personal stories or talk about the norms in the community, again, to model vaccine behavior and to show parents that this is something that they understand and that they are doing, the healthcare provider is doing for their own family. And finally, and also media coverage that shows the popularity of flu clinics, again, modeling the behavior. Also, the impact of self-efficacy, because it was a significant predictor, suggests that you might want to emphasize the ease of access and availability of vaccine more heavily to people, really showing them that this vaccine is available and easy to get. In addition, the cluster analysis with the three groups that we found suggests that we may need to tailor messages for these different groups, the three groups. Oh, and I forgot, I left out one very important point coming back to the three groups, which is that there was no fourth group. There was no group that was more concerned about the disease, that was concerned about the disease but not concerned about vaccines, which was, again, very enlightening to know. So concern and hesitance about vaccines is really trumping concern about many of the diseases that are vaccine preventable. Additionally, ambivalent parents, people who are, you know, worried about both things may really especially need these cues to action to get them moving, because otherwise they may be sort of paralyzed by their indecision, the vaccine versus the disease, which is scarier. So cues to action may be helpful to them. For people who are unconcerned, they may need both those cues to action and maybe a little more risk perception. We can't tell from the data that we have, but it's one area for future investigation. And lastly, vaccine-averse parents may not be directly winnable. I mean, they're a tough audience here, and so going after the other two groups first certainly makes more sense with limited resources. But some of these vaccine-averse parents may still be affected by social norms or other influences like that, so we need to find out more about what would motivate them. Some takeaways for researchers. Disease risk versus vaccine risk is not unambiguous for people. I mean, we were really surprised that the traditional measures of risk, perceived susceptibility and perceived severity, were not more impactful. And when we started looking at it, we were thinking, you know, this is an issue where there are many risks and people are weighing many risks. And we have to keep that in mind, that it's not an either or kind of calculation. For many of the parents, they're really concerned about both sides, you know, about the disease, about the vaccine, and so it's more complex than a lot of our research models allow for. Traditional measures of risk may not capture that complexity. And we need to better understand the relative importance of each of the variables that we looked at. One limitation of our study was, as I mentioned, we were doing this in real time. We were scrambling to get a survey instrument put together and out to people in the early stages of the pandemic. And then this was the follow-up to that longitudinal study. Some of our variables were not as robust as they could be. Self-efficacy, for example, was a one-item measure that dealt with whether or not people felt they could get the vaccine, and that's a much more complex concept. Next time we would like to look more carefully at that. Although in the costs and barrier, or the costs and benefits area, we indirectly got at some things that would deal more with self-efficacy issues, just as we indirectly got at some risk issues. But there are limitations here. And most of all, I think that the big takeaway for us is that this is an area we don't know a lot about yet. And with the current pertussis outbreak and also the potential for unknown pandemics in the future, it's an area that we need to better understand. This was a dress rehearsal for a big pandemic. Hopefully we'll do a better job than 40% the next time.